Do you want to kick off then, young Martin?
Okay.
Hang on.
That's another thing. I haven't got the script. I'm completely out of sorts.
Oh, well, I have got that. Let's give Tim a moment to get organised.
As far as I can tell, everything's absolutely normal.
When we get to the fourth line, what you've got to say, Tim, is, "I'm Tim Elms."
He won't remember that. Remember that.
Can you remember that bit?
Nah, it's too difficult.
This isn't the BBC Light programme. The Tony Hancock Appreciation Society presents, very nearly an armful, a Tony Hancock podcast.
Hello and welcome to Very Nearly an Armful, brought to you by the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society. On the podcast, we'll be discussing the Hancock's Half Hour Theatre Tour.
We'll discuss the show and talk to two of its stars.
We'll talk about the upcoming theatre tour and just generally get our geek on about vintage comedy.
I think we've lost James.
I think he has frozen, yep.
It's going well.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Sorry, my internet. I don't know what's going on.
It's normally mine.
Where did he get to?
It's your turn to say, we're your hosts, James Griffith.
We're your hosts. I'm James Griffith.
I'm Martin Gibbons.
I'm John Street.
And I'm Tim Elms.
And we're spread across the south of the UK in a line from Wiltshire to Essex via Kent.
And we've got members all over the world. We have members in five continents.
And in this podcast special, we're discussing the current Hancock's Half Hour, The Lost Episodes Theatre Tour. We'll be speaking with the tour's stars, John Hewer, who plays Tony Hancock, and Colin Elmer, who plays Kenneth Williams.
First of all, chaps, it's been a long time since we've seen each other, so what have we all been up to?
Well, it's been a busy summer holiday with the grandkids, but it's been lovely. Mostly dry for my holiday from work, out and about, so farms and railways and castles. So it's been a nice summer holiday.
Lovely.
Yes, and I've been busy doing the bonus pages lately and going off to little Hancocky related events and screenings. And I was also quite pleased that there was a couple of albums of Vivian Stanshall released this summer, which have been pending release for about 27 years. And I got a nice little credit in the booklet, which was rather good for being generally quite helpful, which is sort of my thing, really.
Well done, John. That's great to have seen that get a release.
The single shadeless light bulb was so stuck with horrified flies and fat, it seemed to glow through a drunkard's cheek. It salamed the table in red speckles and shone of cosiness, and it took the sharp edge off things, and that's nice. For if it were possible to buy a dark bulb, that is to say, a bulb giving 60 watts of darkness, just strong enough to turn day into night, that would be the bulb Mrs. E, the housekeeper of Rawlinson End, would prefer. She was peeling voles into a bucket, and she fix-eyed intently at a grimy manual entitled How to Cook Everything You Have Killed.
That was a clip from Rawlinson's End, a sequel to Vivian Stanshall's seminal 1978 album Sir Henry Rawlinson End. Both the sequel album and a musical album called Dog Howl in June were produced by Snapper Music and are available from burningshed.com.
Well, I got married and...
Hey.
Oh, did you? Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Back in May. And then, we've been to South Africa very shortly afterwards. Literally within a couple of weeks after I had to go to South Africa for work. And been on several holidays. Went to Martin's neck of the woods, in Canterbury,
Kent.
And been to Cornwall as well. So yeah, all over the place. Yeah,
very nice too.
And a very, very busy summer with the kids, obviously.
Oh, we've lost James and Tim. Oh, he's back.
Busy summer with the kids, James. Excellent. Well, that'll be. We'll hear that later.
We had a few days away back in the New Forest again. It was only planned at the last minute because our holiday in Italy was cancelled, thanks to a fire in Sicily. So anyway, we, as a compensation, we went away for a few days in the New Forest, and we're going away to Italy on another occasion. So that's bit about it. We've had a few days out driving around the Kent and Sussex countryside.
Yep, sounds lovely.
And we even went down to Rye and had a nice little time down there at Rye.
Yeah, it's a lovely, lovely little part of the world.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, it's very nice. Yeah, yeah.
Nice getting out about into nature.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah. And things I've been watching, well, I must mention the repeat run of Hancock's Half Hour on BBC Four.
Absolutely.
Half a dozen repeat episodes, which is absolutely fantastic to see on the television. Bit disappointed it was only six, but keep fingers crossed there might be some more this autumn. But lovely to see them back on the telly.
It was a strange choice of six, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, we started with the blood donor, which of course is what usually happens. But then, as you say, it was a strange choice of six. They seemed to be episodes that were less often repeated, although you could then see the tie-in with other programmes on later in the evening. So we had the Alpine Holiday, which was tied in with the Kenneth Williams drama.
Fantabulosa, isn't it?
That's
right. Fantabulosa, the Kenneth Williams story or something like that. Yeah, Michael Sheen.
Oh, no, it's him again.
Only at this juncture of my professional life can I state my worth as a human being. Because I see that in art is man striving for the truth, for order, for the sense which has evaded him in the stupidity of existence. Only in recognition of this truth in art can my respect be commanded.
He has me in stitches.
That's it. That's the one. And then most amazingly, we had There's an Airfield at the Bottom of My Garden, which had never, ever been repeated before. Partly because that's the one where the set was supposed to collapse at a certain time, and it collapsed rather too early on that, and it was a live broadcast, so there was a lot of ad-libbing and all the rest of it for about 5 or 6 minutes in the middle. So great to see that one repeated. But lovely to see Hancock back on BBC Four.
Also, I've been down to Bognor a few weeks ago to have meetings and discussions with the Punch and Judy Club, because in September we're setting up a Punch and Judy festival in the town to coincide with the 60th anniversary of Hancock's film, The Punch and Judy Man. So we're going to have a showing of the film in a local cinema on the 30th of September, and the Punch and Judy Club are arranging for a big festival in the grounds of the Royal Norfolk Hotel, which is the hotel where Hancock actually stayed during making the film. And we're going to have 10 Punch and Judy booths, I understand. There's going to be music, comedy, magic, all sorts of stuff going on. The daytime event is a completely free family occasion. So we're hoping lots of people will go to Bognor Regis on the weekend of the 30th of September and the 1st of October. So that should be a great occasion. Tickets for the cinema event on the Saturday night, they are not free. Obviously, you need to pay to go to that, but the tickets are actually selling out rather quickly. So by the time this goes out, it might be a sellout. So check the website and see if there are some tickets left. I would grab them.
Yes, it looks to be a really good event. Tim and I will be there with the Society's archives during the day, and some merchandise as well. So, really looking forward to the two-day event.
Talking about Punch and Judy, man, Martin and I, well, and John and Nick, went to Riverside Studios on Saturday to see it on the big screen again there. So that was the first time I'd actually seen it on the big screen. I think for many other people in the studio, it was too.
Yeah, I think it was the first time I'd seen it. I think it had been on at a BFI festival about 15 years ago on the big screen there, but it's the first time I'd seen it on the big screen. And the great restoration that Network did for their Blu-ray and DVD release a couple of years back, it certainly sparkled on the screen. I think the picture quality was absolutely amazing.
Yes, it's lovely to see.
And a lot of positive feedback from the audience, wasn't there? You know?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of positive feedback in the Q&A session afterwards. So, no, it was great to see.
Certainly was, yeah. I think, rest in peace, Network, but their release of it was definitely the best looking it's been. And, it's something quite different. Although seeing it on a big screen does make me think it kind of works on a small screen slightly better as a kind of a drama with a few titters in it rather than an air comedy. So I guess it's time for any tweets and emails that you might have while we're waiting for our gents to join us.
Well, I had an interesting tweet. I'm not sure if we're allowed to call them tweets now. We're meant to call them X.
You've had nicks.
Doesn't sound right, does it?
That's another podcast.
I need a special dispensation to continue to use tweets, because I cannot get my head around saying I received an X, I sent an X. It just doesn't
make sense.
It doesn't quite work, does it?
It doesn't.
No.
You can't believe what this loon in America has done with Twitter. Anyway, I tweeted a quote from Hancock. It's the one about driving a tram, and he says that when the trolley buses comes in, he was completely cold boxed, and that's an expression that crops up several times in Hancock's half hour in the context. I was out of options, or I didn't know what to do.
If Mr. Parnell sees that letter, I'm finished in show business. Then what will I do? My only other trade is tram driving. There's not much demand for those in London. Of course, I was redundant when the trolley buses came in. I was all right on swinging the old brass handles. But the steering wheel and no lines to help you out, I was coal boxed right away. Never any good at conducting either. I couldn't master the punch. Never once did I get the little O in between the right line.
And one of the replies I had was from Mark Lamar, who's a comedian and...
Never mind the Buzzcocks, he used to present, didn't he, back in the day?
That's right, yeah. And he was on with Vic and Bob on Lucky Stars, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Love that, absolutely love that. But Mark said, what a brilliant expression cold boxed is, and he looked it up. And apparently it was an expression, a World War I expression for howitzer shells. But it made me think about, well, yes, that might have been what they called a howitzer shell, but how did it get into the usage that Hancock used? And I did a bit of looking up. Someone on Twitter said that a friend of theirs who was a Cockney used to use it for an expression for being wrecked, you know, if you've been out on the sauce and had too much, the next morning he was cold boxed, which I thought was quite interesting.
Oh.
What we'd like to know from any listeners is, if, you know, where does this expression come from? One of the things I suggested was that when there was a slang term used in Hancock's half hour, there was one or two sources. Either it come from Birmingham, which was Hancock's stumping, well, not his stumping ground, but his place of birth. And obviously growing up with a Brummy mother and father would pick up these expressions. And the other one, of course, was Gorton & Simpson on the streets of South London. But I know a lot of people from the South London, East London area, and know a lot of London slang, but I've never heard that one. I reckon it's probably Birmingham.
It could be. I'm sure there was a thing in one of the missing pages 10 or 15 years ago about some of these phrases. And I can't remember if coal box is one that comes up, but it may have been. So might be worth a delve through the old magazines to see if it comes up.
There's so much information in our old magazines, isn't there?
Yes.
Yes. One of our members is creating an index of all our magazines for that very reason, so that we can look at things like this more easily.
Yeah, that's great to see, because there's an awful lot of them going back 47 years.
And another tweet I did was, you know, the quote from the reunion party when Hancock is ordering all the booze in the off license. And one of the things he orders is dragon's breath. You remember that?
Oh, I do remember that, yes.
Yeah. Yes, dragon's breath.
Apparently that's now a real beer, and it's sold by the Dartmoor Brewery. So you can actually go out and have a dragon's breath now. I haven't heard of any brewery doing a horse's collar, but you can have a dragon's breath.
There we are, James. A little challenge for you there, I think.
Oh, well, yes. I will I'll have a look for that, yeah. I do look out for horse's collar. Obviously, I'm in pubs quite a lot for my line of work. But, I always think
you're
horse's
just in
collar.
Pubs quite a lot, James.
Yeah. Who am I kidding?
Just like Geoffrey Bernard. That's a wonderful play with Peter O'Toole. Geoffrey Bernard is unwell. Highly recommended.
Oh, I've not seen that.
One day I was asked to write my autobiography, and I put a letter in the Spectator asking if anyone could tell me what I was doing between 1960 and 1974.
Dear Mr. Bernard, I read with interest your letter asking for information as to your behaviour and whereabouts between the years 1960 to 1974. On a certain evening in September 1969, You rang my mother to inform her that you were going to murder her only son. If you would like further information, I can put you in touch with many people who have enjoyed similar bizarre experiences in your company. Yours sincerely, Michael J. Malloy, editor, Daily Mirror.
It's a good thing I can hold this stuff tolerably well. I mean, if I were a Yob or a Hooray Henry, by the time the pub opens again, I could be one of those cases found by the coroner to have choked on their own vomit. Disgusting phrase! When did you hear of anyone choking on someone else's vomit?
And now for our main subject, Hancock's Half Hour, the Lost Episodes Theatre Tour. We'll be speaking with the tour stars, John Hewer, who's playing Tony Hancock, and Connie Elmer, who plays Kenneth Williams. Well, chaps, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having us, guys.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Right, that's it. Thanks very much.
That's it, yeah. Yeah.
Well done. That's it. It's a wrap.
I should have mentioned I can only ad-lib given 3 months' notice. Sorry about that.
Oh, well. We're not entirely different. This is why we edit ourselves a lot.
Shall I kick off, chaps?
Go for it, dude.
John and Colin, you're appearing in this show, John as Hancock and Colin as Kenneth Williams. You've both played these characters before. How did you get involved with this?
After you, Colin.
Go on, John, you first, mate. I'm just going to plug myself a bit. There we are, so I can hear you all properly.
I first got to play Tony Hancock in 2012 in a production through my own theatre company. I met Galton and Simpson, wonderful Ray and Alan, at the South Bank event of a reading of the film The Day Off.
Oh, right.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh. Remember that.
19 years ago that was, wasn't it? Was that 2004 or was that 2014? No, 10 years ago.
Yeah,
10 years ago.
12, I think it was. Yeah. And I was at the book signing. I was very much just carried away by it all. I thought it was a wonderful event, and it meant a lot to Ray and Alan and to all the fans there. And then when I got home, I found a book somewhere called the Missing Hancocks. What's it called? The Lost Hancocks.
Oh, the Lost Scripts.
Yes. And I was living in London at the time, and I was sat on the tube, and I was reading the books, the scripts. And I was laughing out loud. Now, anyone who's been on a London tube knows to laugh out loud.
Unspoken scene.
Yes. It's game over, isn't it? It's very much game over. But there I was laughing out loud. I'm thinking, this is brilliant. These scripts are, you know, best part of 60 years old. It's incredible. You know, why, you know, obviously they're lost, but I can't see a reason why someone hasn't tried to do them before. And I just bit the bullet and I contacted Tessa, their agent, and I said, look, I'm no Bill Kenwright, you know, I'm no Cameron McIntosh, but I do really, really want to do this very small scale back up north in Lincolnshire where I'm based. You know, we've been going for about 5 years at that point, and we just love this kind of classic comedy. And bless her, Tessa said, I don't know how much this is true, but she's like, oh, that's a good idea. No one's thought of doing that before. And I was like, wow, that's very sweet of you. And it just kind of went from there. And we did it very rurally around here, a bit of Yorkshire, a bit of Nottinghamshire as well. And then we were in with the guy, Michael Kingsbury, who ran the White Bear Theatre in London, who was very big in the Round the Horn revival about 10 years before that. And he said, well, why don't you do it like an alternative Christmas show? We'll book you for about 10 days in that awkward gap between Christmas and New Year. And we did, and we didn't think it would sell great because it was the time of year, and you know, we're not names or anything like that, and you know, but it sold out constantly. It was wonderful, and I haven't done it since. Now I look back on those times and I think, oh, I should really have you know monopolized on that success and just kept touring it, and you know, there was an audience for it. But at that time I was 23, 24, and I wanted to try different things and go back to new writing and all sorts. And then I fell into doing the Stepped Son shows as well, and Tommy Cooper and that kind of stuff. But Hancock has always been there in the back of my mind. I got quite jealous when other people were doing Hancock, thinking, oh, that's great. Because, you know, I did that. And I know that feeling. And I know what that means to share those wonderful scripts.
Yeah.
And then I teamed
did
up.
Did you
with...
know Hancock before that, John? Did you used to listen to Hancock?
Yeah, I did know Hancock's work a lot. My mum worked in the library up here in Grimsby. And there'd be many a time when I would be left alone while she was finishing off work and I was in the library just pottering around. And they had a book by Robert Ross called The Carry On Companion. And once I'd completely absorbed all of that, I was like, right, okay, so I now know the carry-ons, you know, back of my hand now. And what else do these people do? And then so I Sid James, Hattie Jakes, Kenneth Williams, they're all in this thing called Hancock's Half Hour. Let's try that. And then I remember, oh, hang on, my grandpa used to have some Hancock's cassettes. And I remember very specifically, it was Mystery Tours.
You pay me the money and I give you a tour. That sounds all right. I'll have 2 5-shilling ones.
And a very wise choice you've made. A delightful tour you've chosen there. Not as long as the 35 and sixpenny one, of course, but nevertheless interesting.
Good. When do we start?
As soon as you like.
All right, then. I'll go now.
All right, then. Cheerio.
Cheerio. What do you mean, cheerio?
Well, you said you were off.
But where's the guide?
I'm the guide.
Well, aren't you coming with us?
No, I can't leave the office.
Well, how can you guide us then?
Oh, that's easy. You turn left at the traffic lights, up the high street, first left, second right, first left round the gasworks, over the railway bridge, past the reservoir, round the back of the town hall, up the alleyway, and back here.
That's not much of a tour, is it?
Well, what do you expect for a dollar?
No, I suppose so. Oh, all right, then where's the coach?
What coach?
The coach that we tour in.
I didn't say anything about a coach. You got to walk.
An Unexploded Bomb. They are the two I really remember sat with in my nan's living room. They were cooking shepherd's pie or something in the kitchen, and I had half an hour before dinner was ready. And I used to just listen to them all the time.
It's a what?
A bomb, an unexploded bomb.
You mean that I've been down since here in down all these years?
I'm afraid so.
What? Here? Down in all of me upstairs.
Oh. I don't think Mr. Hancock is feeling well. Perhaps you ought to sit down.
Yeah, come on, Top, sit down, have a rest. Come on, old son, over here.
Thank you. Not on the bum! Go and reserve me a bunk in the underground station. We're getting out of here.
Come, come, come now. This is no time to panic.
It's a good enough time for me, mate. I'm off.
And I love reading scripts. And Gott and Simpson are very good at sharing their scripts. So I remember, you know, it was quite easy to get hold in secondhand books, you know, the best of Hancock and this kind of stuff. And so I'd often read it before I heard it or watched it. And by this point, where the DVDs were starting to come out, There was a Comedy Greats VHS collection. They had all had white covers. There was Morecambe Wise and Two Ronnies and Spike.
Yeah, I remember those. Well. Yeah. Frankie Howard, all of them.
And they did Hancock's with like the postcards as well. And so I got to know Hancock visually through those, his last series, obviously, the one without Sid James, ironically. And then when they start to bring the ones out on DVD, you know, in order, the volumes, that's when I was really, really excited to see those. But so that's my personal love for Hancock.
And I remember going to see the your lost episode show at the White Bear, wasn't it?
That's right. Yes, I remember meeting you there. It was wonderful. Thank you so much for your support there. It was great.
I didn't see it at the time, but I have seen the video because you did The Winter Holiday, which is, I think, part of the lineup this time round, and the Italian Maid.
Yeah,
which was obviously a TV one, which was, you know, with full sets and everything, which looks lovely. I thought that's the wonderful way to experience it. Obviously, the soundtrack turned up later.
Yes, it did, and it's eerie because I was a bit to listen to the original recording. I was like, oh God, we got something completely wrong. But then I listened to extracts of it, and I was like, oh, actually, we're not far off with this.
Pretty with the way we read the script.
Who'd think these once elegant money clutchers
wants to caress the bare backs of debutantes at the Café Royal. Once fondled the stems of delicate hock glasses, bulging with Yugoslavian Riesling.
And look at them today, dead things hanging off the end of my arms.
Well, a couple of jars of cold cream, they'll be as good as new.
Nah, they've had it. Take it from me, they'll never hold a violin again, Sid. I'll never get the flight of the bumblebee out of these again.
Well, you need a change, boy. I mean, all work and no play makes Jack a right Toby.
I was very proud of that, and it was nice to do a radio episode and a TV episode, because it meant Act 2, the curtains would open, and, you know, oh wow, all of a sudden we've got this, you know, 23 railway cuttings mock-up. It was,
yes,
it was nice to do.
Because Kevin and co did the Marriage Bureau in The Missing Hancock, so then that episode turned up, didn't it? So yeah, they must have had a similar feeling. Yeah.
Yeah, that was fascinating, wasn't it, to listen to those side by side and see how accurate they were and how they were interpreted.
Yeah. We did a podcast on it, and I had, what I did in preparation for the podcast on that episode was play the two episodes sort of line by line together, and it was incredible how close it was. It was, I mean, Kevin, you know, was really spot on with, well, they all were. I mean, you know,
but yes,
it was very good.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure I've heard that Kevin McNally listened to both side by side in segments and was quite pleased with how on the money he was. I can't remember where I heard that, but I heard it somewhere.
Yeah, it was great. No, I mean, it was good. Of course, that one was a little different between The Missing Hancocks and the original, because the original had Peter Sellers, and of course, when it was recreated, it had the Kenneth Williams character, but they both worked really well. Oh, it was that's a great episode. Fantastic to have that one found.
Definitely, definitely, yeah.
Whether or not we offer you employment depends entirely upon the answers you have given.
All right. I've answered all the questions.
And let us continue. Question one was, what is an isosceles triangle? And you have answered yes.
That's it.
That is not the right answer.
All right, then. No.
That also is not the right answer.
I get your little game. It's a trick question.
No, Mr. Hancock, I'm sorry. No, this just is not good enough, I'm sorry.
All right, then. What is an isosceles triangle? Go on, you tell me.
An isosceles triangle is a triangle whose angles at the base are equal.
Just a tick, I'll write it in. Isosceles triangle, angle at the base is equal. There you are, that's one right. Carry on.
And what about yourself, Colin?
Well, I was actually curious to know why. I know you probably covered this before, guys, why Peter Sellers actually rocked up in that particular episode. It's fascinating that he did, but obviously it's just completely sort of out of left field, isn't it?
Yeah, we've done a bit of research on it. I mean, Kenneth was unavailable, is what it says in all the books, and Peter stepped in at the last minute. And the word is that Dennis Main Wilson got in touch with them, and he was able to do it because, by a strange quirk of fate, they weren't recording a Goon Show that week. They'd done two the week before. But when you look in Kenneth Williams' diaries, he doesn't mention the fact that he was unavailable. But what he does say is that following day was his opening night in that Charles Bernard Shaw play.
The St. Joan.
St. Joan, that's right. So
yes,
he would have been involved in dress rehearsals and all sorts of stuff for his opening night the following day. So we think that's why he probably slipped out of Hancock that week.
Yes.
Because he was opening in that show the following day. And so we're assuming, I mean, it sounds right, but I mean, obviously we don't know for sure.
It lines up, doesn't it?
And also this recording they did for Hancock's Half Hour was done very late at night. In fact, Peter Sellers travelled down from the north to attend it. Sellers walked in and did it with sort of, you know, literally 10 minutes preparation.
Yes.
And it was done about 10 o'clock at night or whatever. So again, that would have made it difficult for Williams, you know, bearing in mind it was his big night the following night.
Yes, playing the Dauphin, I believe, in St. Joan.
That's right, yes. He played it before, hadn't he? I think when Gordon Simpson first cast him for Hancock's Half Hour, that's the play they saw him.
That's exactly
I think
it.
Was it Roy Spears saw him and recommended it or something like that to Dennis?
I think it was probably a few. I know that Dennis Main Wilson, I think, certainly saw it because it was through Kenneth's versatility as a character actor on stage, as obviously as you know, he playing the Dauphin, he
has to start off as this very young character. And by the end, he plays this very old king. Or as he said, you know, quite a common king now that I come to think of it. And it was through this change. Because he had no time to sort of, he had no time for hair or makeup. So he had to do the whole thing, you know, physically with the change in the face and the voice to play this very old man. And showing that rage live on stage. Yeah. Was really the why he got the job, to play all these different characters in Hancock.
Yeah, to be the little voice man.
So how did you get involved in Kenneth Williams then, Colin?
How did I get in Ken? I'll start off as I mean to finish. It's no double entendre left unturned. Well, a bit like John, actually, mate. I think we both sort of grew up listening to Hancock and was aware of the Carry On films and all these sort of different comedy greats. The Goon Show I came to a bit later on. I personally came to start playing Kenneth Williams through this very same company that is presenting Hancock's Half Hour, Apollo Theatre Company. Tim Astley, producer, director. He was casting, this is back in 2015, the 50th anniversary of another great radio classic, Round the Horn.
Hello, I'm Julian, and this is my friend Sandy.
Oh, hello, Mr. Lord, and welcome to Marty and Donnie again.
Oh, Charles, you mustn't. Oh, Charles, you mustn't.
Look what I've got in my hand.
Marty!
About this complaint.
Yes, yes, it's about the amount of sex and violence and depravity on television.
Yes, well, we're doing all we can about it.
You may be, but there's still not enough.
It was 50 years since originally it was put on air in 1965, where it ran for till 1968. Kenneth Swan's very sad passing. And I auditioned for that, and lo and behold, I got it. And I got the call that I'd be playing Kenneth on my 30th birthday. So that was so many years ago now, obviously. So, and yeah, that was, I always say, that's the best birthday present I've ever had, to be able to play Kenneth on stage. Because, again, like you've just said, John, you hear other people taking these comedy greats off, you think, oh, I really want to do this. I'm dying to do it, because since I was probably a certain age, when a couple of items began to drop, I found that I could do a Kenneth. You see, you need that timbre in the voice, and which you can't do when you're very, very young, unless you're just doing this right. Nigh voice.
Adenoidal, I suppose, haven't you, really?
You have, yes. As you once described, a wasp with adenoids. And from a very young age, I started sort of doing all these impressions, people like Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole, Kenneth Williams. And Kenneth was sort of one of the first ones I did. And, you know, it's I think other teenagers in a Suffolk school were sort of too busy chasing girls, and I was listening to old comedy greats and trying to hone down these voices. So, I was really popular at school, I'm telling. But it was
served you in good stead, though.
I was going to ask, you both done sort of like a deep dive into their characters to really get to know their backgrounds in order to help your performance on the stage? Is one thing I was sort of thinking about, like how much for a research you do a proper Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, live and breathe in for a little bit before
doing the method, yeah.
How what's your approach, both of you?
Based on the rather both figures, I think, of Hancock and Williams were full of contradictions. I think if we went full method, I dread to think what would probably happen to us.
Become a nervous wreck or something, yes.
Yes, exactly. I'd end up probably writing in my diary every night, being extremely angry and annoyed. And what would you be doing, John? Probably poring over philosophy.
I'll be down the pub,
and...
yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Oh, I'd do that anyway, mate. Come on. I mean, you know. There's that story, isn't there? I think, is it Geoffrey Bernard, the famous Soho journalist, once interviewed, I think it was Tony Hancock. I may be wrong in this, but I think he was interviewing Tony Hancock once, and they both got absolutely blasted in a pub. And Geoffrey Bernard left Hancock in the taxi on their way back to their respective homes, and Hancock had just completely collapsed in the cab. And Geoffrey Bernard said, "I think you've got a drinking problem." Well, if it takes Geoffrey Bernard to tell you you've got a drinking problem, you do. You've got a problem.
Yeah. I think that's part of the play with Peter O'Toole. I'm sure that line's in there somewhere.
Well,
there's a John Lemayers that pops up in it at some point as a character. Wonderful play.
Oh, yes, he does. Yes. Mm. Hello, Dennis. Working. Yeah. Awfully yeah. good. Awfully good.
One night, that dear, sweet man, John Lemessurier. Now, there was another character. One night, John Lemessurier was walking along Piccadilly when he saw Dennis Shaw being bundled into a Black Maria for drunk and disorderly. John Lemessurier gave Den one of his affable smiles and said,
"Hello, Dennis. Working?"
There's another great story about, was it Peter O'Toole was in the stalls once at the theatre and with his friends, and he said, "Oh, watching this play," and halfway through he goes, "You'll love this bit. This is where I come on," and oh, bugger. But yeah, so that's, anyway, sorry, I'm always going off on tangents, but that's how I actually started playing Kenneth Williams. Was back in 2015 for Raoul Horne, and since then, through Apollo Theatre Company, we've also created a niche for creating these brilliant recreations of these old radio classics. So we've done Round the Hall many, many times. The Goon Show was another one we did a few years ago. And of course, we've added since to then Hancock's Half Hour. This is actually our second time with this. In fact, I'm actually thinking of just changing my actor's name to Renter Ken. It might be easier. With a slight detour playing Spike Milligan.
You do Spike as well. I didn't realise you did Spike.
Yes.
All of the spikes.
To add to what Colin's just said, a little story I've got is my wife is also an actor, and she looks a little bit younger than her age, and she's still getting cast as teenagers and this kind of stuff. And she got a bit upset about it at one point. She's like, "Oh, I'm still playing teenagers, and I'm 33 or whatever." And I go, "Look at me, I've been playing dead people since I'm 24.
Yeah.
You know?
Because you've done Steptoe and Tommy Cooper on stage as well, I think, in the past, haven't you, John, as part of the Hambledon Productions?
Yeah, new horse! We've got to have another horse, haven't we? Well, I mean, haven't you got no feelings at all? I mean, Hercules, hardly cold in his tins, and you want to go out and get another!
Life must go on, Dad. I'm as cut up about it as you are.
You're not as cut up as the horse is.
Is that you, Harold?
I guess. Where are you?
In the bedroom.
Harold!
Yeah, that's right. Yes, that kind of, you know, I do class as the golden era of entertainment. I think, you know, that the 50s, 60s, 70s. I really do. It's the stuff I always fall back on when I want a guaranteed laugh. And you know, it's a pure belly chuckle, or it's just nostalgia. So I do look at those people a lot. Going back to the previous question, I think it's just all about being very open and very respectful to the original performers, and particularly with Tony Hancock and Tommy Cooper and Harry H. Corbett. You know, it was always been very important to me personally to try and find their family members, their colleagues, their writers, and all that, often before the first tour date's been decided or the scripts have been decided or anything like that. You want to, you know, it's very humbling, because to us they're comedy icons, but to these people it's their dads.
Yeah,
and,
yes,
you know, it's of course, their heroes, yes, as well. And you've got to be very careful with that. I've got to admit, when I first did Hancock, there was a little part of me was like, I don't need to be the greatest Hancock in the world. I don't need to be, because people, one, they're not going to turn up unless they want to see Hancock's Half Hour. They know what they let themselves in for. But more importantly, these are lost episodes. At that point, there was no recordings or remakes or anything like that. So the fans are just going to be grateful that someone's bothering to do it. So there was that kind of safety net always in my mind. And that was also a big thing for me when I did Tommy Cooper.
You know, I bought a car. I bought a car for my wife last week. That's not a bad swap. Playing cards. I bought this for a Christmas present for my wife. Christmas present. It's not a main present. It's a stocking filler.
When I first did Tommy Cooper and Steptoe and Son, is that there? I was using scripts and jokes and sketches that had been lost. So there was always that kind of golden nugget for the hardcore, you know, purists to kind of latch onto. We were still doing something quite new. And I think that's what's very good about this, is that even though they have been remade, it's just another retake on it. And it's keeping that legacy alive, which is, as we all know, is critical when these things, you know, they're now 60, 70 years old, some of them. It's important we get that word out there.
Because that's the interesting one, because obviously you did the Hancock's Half Hour Theatre tour in, I think, was it 2018, 2019, Colin?
Yes.
And those were existing episodes. Did you find yourself listening to those episodes, or did you try to avoid doing so before you did your tour of ones that exist, where you kind of got a template you can follow almost?
I don't think it would have made any difference, Jonathan. I've listened to them all so often that I sort of knew them by osmosis anyway.
Yeah.
A bit like John, I grew up listening to Hancock and Round the Horn and the Navy Lark. Other, as you quite rightly say, John, it was the golden age of British radio comedy, which obviously in some circumstances transcended over to television as well. So yeah, that's really, I think just to mirror what John said, you have a great responsibility to do these performers justice and the writing justice as well.
Right, men, you have all been training now for 6 weeks, and tomorrow you'll be going out into the nasty, cruel world as fully fledged constables. This is my way of being a final examination. Step forward, PC Hancock. Sir, will you please demonstrate lesson number 23?
23, yes, certainly, sir. Right, come along there. Move along, please. You're blocking the pavement, please. Move along there, please.
Oh, excellent, excellent, yes. 8 out of 10. You were swinging your truncheon a little too wildly. Watch it, ducky. No, you must aim it, otherwise perfect.
The fact that, you know, you can listen to these comedies, Hancock, obviously, as we're discussing this now, 70 years later, and yeah, there's the odd sort of reference which might not sort of, you know, ring for a lot of people, but the value of the writing is just immeasurable. It's fantastic. It doesn't date. It's about human condition, Hancock being the little man. It's just phenomenal. It's fantastic.
Shaking your fist at the world, which we kind of all still do to this day, I suppose, to some extent or another.
Oh, yes, especially at the moment under the current Tory administration. But there you go.
Yes.
Get that one in. Up the workers. Right.
Yes. Right up.
Good morning, Cheeky. Want to come to the pictures with me?
Hoppet, get out of it. Go home.
Don't be like that. I saw you wink at me.
I did not wink at you. Full silence, just drop down, that's all. Now go on, buzz off, hop it.
I think you'll smash him.
I shall slosh you in a minute.
Oh, that's it. I like girls, a bit of spirit, a bit of fire. I bet you're Mexican or something, ain't you?
I am not Mexican. I come from Cheam, if it's a little. Now go on, clear off, you might get hurt.
You were right, little spitfire, didn't you? You fascinating little minx, you. Come here!
Do you mind, sir? I dare
you! You tantalise a man to you, drive him to distraction. Go on, have that come with the pictures with me.
You're making a big mistake. Things aren't what they seem. Now go and find somebody else.
No, I want you.
Well, it's quite interesting because, I mean, you talk about both of you, your love of Hancock, but compared to many of us in the society, not all, he said, looking at John and James, is that you're of course quite so young. And a lot of the younger generation are taking the Hancock, and we've noticed it in the society. You know, a lot of our our membership is still growing, but it's people of your age, really. It's not people of my age. And it makes you wonder why this is, really. I mean, obviously, we always say the comedy is timeless. I find it fascinating that youngsters today are tuning into Hancock's Half Hour on BBC Sounds or watching it when it was recently repeated on TV or whatever. You know, I just find that fascinating. Yeah.
Well, we saw our youngest member, didn't we, young David, on the Punch and Judy Man screening, and he's there, yeah. What is he, 12, 11, he's 12, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
I suppose it's that thing of those characters are kind of archetypes, aren't they?
And we got James's son, Monty, come to our last dinner, didn't he?
Yeah, he's coming this year as well. Yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah.
He's 11, younger still. He's 11.
He's 11,
yeah.
He's not just coming to go with his dad. He actually liked Hancock, doesn't he?
He does love it, yeah. I think it's just so accessible now, isn't it? I think that's the beauty of the modern age to an extent. You've got the internet and you can find anything on there. But we didn't have that when we were growing up. We had to we heard about it from our parents and families and friends, and we got the tapes. We listened to the records, and it wasn't on the radio. Yeah. It wasn't, you know.
No, it was hardly ever on the radio. You were relying on whatever the BBC released on LP or cassette.
You forget how much, as you just said, it's so much more widely available now. A click of a button, you can relive all the old Hancock episodes, as with a lot of other comedies.
Yeah.
But I suppose, with like all of us, really, whatever our ages are, we all started listening to Hancock when we were really young. And certainly for myself and John, you've mentioned, you sort of found cassettes and VHSs of them. I think in my case, I actually remember the first time I listened to Hancock. It was one of those, do you remember when the Radio Times, they probably still do it, you have to cut out coupons and send about 5,000 of them to the Radio Times office, and you get one cassette back, which is probably, God knows how many editions of the Radio Times. You probably had to spend about, you know, $5,000 worth of copy to get this cassette back. And it was, again, it was something like Comedy Greats, presented by Paul Merton.
Paul Merton, I remember that. Yeah. I remember the cassette, yeah.
I've got it in a drawer probably somewhere next to me, amidst lots of old batteries and other things. And it was Paul Merton presenting these various excerpts of all these comedies. And the one I listened to, it was about 2 minutes of Hancock. And it was the old school reunion where Tony is putting on the blazer to revisit his old public school.
Yes.
Was it Bill Kerr said, "Is that a blazer? I thought it was a deck chair."
Greystones?
Yes, the finest public school in the country. I was there for 7 years.
I had no idea you were a public school boy, Tub.
What? Oh, my gosh. Yaru, Lego. Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Haven't you seen my striped blazer hanging up in the wardrobe?
Is that a blazer? I thought it was a deck chair.
They were the school colours, I'll have you know. Red, green, mauve and heliotrope. I hope the moths haven't got at it.
They wouldn't go near that without dark glasses.
You are mocking the most cherished of our institutions, the British Public School. Ah, dear old Greystone, 7 of the happiest years of my life. Started off as a fag and worked my way up to Ed Cigar.
And I was just hooked at these two voices. And at that point, I didn't even know that Kenneth Williams was in it, because even at that young age, I was probably about 6 or 7, I knew of Kenneth and Sid James, of course, from the Carry On films. Mm-hmm. So, because they were obviously played a lot more. And so that's how I actually got into sort of listening to it in the first place. And like John, I then started buying all of these cassettes. If I was lucky enough to go on holiday with my parents, and I'm not really one for sort of beach holidays or anything, so I'd have to bring literally a ton of cassettes with me just to sort of get through wherever it was we were. Mm-hmm. And I'd just be listening to these radio comedies constantly. And so I think, I think it's hardly surprising that young people continue to latch on to things like Hancock, because thankfully now they don't have to sort of do what John and I did, or you guys had to do, and root out and find this stuff. It's there. And it's, you know, the hunger for it is immense.
It is.
I remember when they started to bring out the collector's editions box sets, like series by series.
Oh, the CDs, yes. Yep.
Yeah, the CDs. And I remember, because they were quite costly for little old me, 14 years old. They were expensive. and I would have to save up pocket money to get them. But I was excited because I like the fact they're in chronological order, and I like I could see the series develop. For some reason, I didn't get series one or two. For some reason, I don't know, but I got series three, and I've listened to that series in particular so over and over again, more times than just the Blood Donor. It's just I just remember it felt worth so much, and there was so much on it. You know, there was about, you know, 12 episodes, 13 episodes, I think, from the third series, and that was great. So I think although we have. What, you know, Colin's absolutely right. Like, it's so accessible now. It's like two buttons away. It's free, you know, and it's just there, and you can dip in and out of it as you want to. But the fact that you had to invest in it so much meant that you really did stay with it a lot. And
yes,
And I like I say, I live in rural Lincolnshire, so it's always at least a 40-minute drive to anywhere. So you always listen. You always had at least two Hancock episodes, or the Navy Lark, or the Goon Show, whatever. Every time you left the house. So that was a very nice thing as well. And like Colin, I wasn't one for beach holidays in that sense, but whereas Colin had the cassettes, I would have the scripts. So I would have the books. I'd be reading those. Happy time.
Oh, actually, I think I did as well, mate. I think I had the, it's probably on the bookshelf behind me, the Best of Hancock.
Yeah.
I remember getting that out from the library and persevering through prickly heat and God knows what else I was going for at the time, just reading these scripts.
Yeah.
And that's the one with the wonderful illustrations by John Ireland in it.
Yes.
Wonderful caricatures. I was
just given that copy a few years ago. I think I was either touring with Hancock or with Round the Horn, and where I was staying, one of my digs, really lovely guy in Cheltenham, he said, oh, I know you're playing Kenneth Williams. Here, have this. And he just gave me this book. So occasionally you pick up things on tour.
Oh, that's really nice. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But the books or the scripts are brilliant. And it really, particularly with the lost episodes, it was at that time was the only way you could really get access. Obviously only get access to the scripts. And of course, there was no recorded version available. So they were worth their weight in gold.
I think that's also the great challenge for John and I as well. Although, of course, they have been recreated, these particular episodes, by Kevin McNally et al., is that, you know, we don't have the existing recordings. I've done the, as you've mentioned, John, Jonathan, the previous tour we did existing episodes. So for this, there is a certain amount, I guess, of interpretation of how they would have performed this, what the delivery would have been. And in Kenneth's case, purely on my own, is that... as he was employed as the character actor, which voice would it have used for this particular
part? Of course.
So obviously, it's always very obvious where the Snide character comes
generally.
In. But should I use the old man's voice, or should I use the pseudo Cockney voice? You know, that kind of thing. So that's what's fascinating. But going back to what you were discussing earlier about how accurate the guys were when they recreated the Marriage Bureau and then they found the original episode. I think it's probably a really good key to understanding how iconic their delivery was. When you read the script, you can hear them saying these words because Galton and Simpson just wrote so perfectly for Hancock. They just created this sort of amazing sort of half reality, half art imitating life character, as they did, of course, with Sid embellishing him as the kind of the rough diamond character, and Bill as this, you know, obviously not an idiot, but this very good natured and lovely Australian guy.
He sort of starts out wide boy and slowly turns into Stan Laurel, doesn't he, over time?
He does.
Yes.
The IQ definitely drops through the series, doesn't it?
Yes.
Shall we have a chat at this stage about the other cast members who are appearing alongside you? We're really pleased to have you both with us in the podcast, but obviously there's other cast members.
There are indeed, Jan.
Ben Craze is playing Sid James. I remember seeing Ben in the last Apollo tour with you, Colin. And I remember I was in one, it might have been Richmond, which I remember went down particularly well. It's a fantastic night.
Yes, lovely theatre.
But I remember in one of the venues, I think it was Ben's first line of the evening was something like, "Hello, Hancock."
Yeah.
And he got a round of applause from the audience. It was just, all he said was "Hello, Hancock," and the audience just were absolutely, you know, there was a buzz went round. It was just brilliant.
Boots marching up and down again. Boots. Oh, you copper. Yes, sir, can I be of any... Hello, it's Sid. Oh, blimey, Hancock. You frightened the life out of me in that fancy dress. What's the big idea? Well, I've joined the force. Police Constable Hancock. Metropolitan Police at your service. Here, can I tell you the time?
You in the Knox?
Yes, and Bill too.
Oh, blimey, what a stroke of luck.
Pardon?
Oh, nothing. Tell me, you on the beat every night?
Yes, yes, every night. Patrolling all of these posh shops here.
And whose beat's on the other side of the road?
Bill's.
It gets better every minute. So, you two between you constitute the only law around here for a mile and a half.
Yes, that's right.
I don't believe it.
I'm so glad you said that, Tim. I was going to sort of bring this up anyway, is that it's a joy every night to see the audience reactions to everyone, really, but with Ben, because Sid James is such an iconic voice, as is everyone's voice in the show, but it's a very difficult voice. People think because it's he's Cockney that it's quite low pitched. It's rather high pitched, and you've got the South African element in there as well, and that lovely glint in the eye that just comes through. It's a pleasure every night just to see the audience reactions to Ben as Sid James. Well, it's so heartwarming.
Well, that wood alcohol voice, as Tony once describes it, isn't he?
Well, yeah.
It's a quite good description of it, really.
You're all right, you're clean. You can turn around now.
Thank you. I'll have my watch back if you'd... Sid James, I might have known. I thought I recognised that wood alcohol voice of yours. I should have guessed it was someone like you behind this affront to the British sense of fair play.
Don't you talk to me like that, you old reprobate.
I didn't do it, you know that. Why, it's unthinkable. I wouldn't dare risk it, a man in my position. This has completely ruined me for housewife's choice, you realise that?
Was it face like a dissipated walnut, I think he once described himself.
Sounds about
Sydney,
right.
Not Ben, I should say.
Yes, well, indeed. Well, Ben looks the part. He doesn't quite look dissipated walnut, but he looks good for the Sid role, doesn't he?
Well, Sid was a very handsome guy. I remember seeing that film, What a Carb Up, and he takes his shirt off at one point. My God, he's built like a rig outhouse, isn't he? Because he was a boxer as well.
Well, he used to say he was. I think he was a ladies' hairdresser. I think there's a lot of stuff invented about his past. So hard to say.
He was a huffer as well, wasn't he? He was an excellent vaudeville performer when he came over from South Africa originally. But I'm so glad because actually we've got quite a new cast this time round. Partly because obviously with the previous episodes featured Hattie Jade, because they were the later series. Obviously, the lost episodes are all the original, like series one and two, and a few more through there, because it's about 25 that were lost in total. So we have Andre Melle this time, who is played by Alice Osmanski, who I haven't worked with before, as same with Callum Hale, who plays Bill Kerr. And of course, John, this is actually our first time working together, although we do know, I think, our respective works. We've been sort of following each other and seeing what each other's been doing. So I just can't wait to begin. We've got such a wonderful cast lined up.
Yes, and of course you've got Clive Greenwood coming back as the announcer.
We do indeed. My apologies, Clive, I didn't forget you.
For this series. And I think he did Round the Horn, didn't he?
Clive was in The Goon Show.
Oh, that was it.
I say, Seagoon, it's getting dark. You can't see in this light, you know. I'll strike a match!
Buys.
Who are you?
Me? Oh, I'm Lance Private Eccles, but most people call me by my nickname.
What's that?
Nick. I made a joke about the Nick.
I inspected the man closely. Oh. He was the nearest thing I had seen to a human being without actually being one.
Oh. I say, Seagoon, you surely don't suspect this man. Why, we were together in the same company during that terrible disaster.
What company was that?
Desert Song, 1933.
Were you both in the doily cart?
Oh, yes, right in the doily cart.
I don't wish to know that.
I say.
Thank you, Jim.
Wonderfully played, Harry Seacombe. And he recently, I guess he was in our production of Round Hall last year as the BBC announcer. So he's sticking with that role again.
I am your BBC staff announcer, and I shall also be providing the sound effects live. Again, how kind, ladies and gentlemen, yes. Two jobs for which, sadly, I receive only one salary. Thank you for the sympathy, sir, but I blame Lord Reith and the cuts in the BBC. Secondly, may I remind you that we are going to be recording three episodes this evening. So don't all rush out to the bar after the first one, despite the fact that you might need a stiff drink to calm your nerves. And finally, may I remind you that this is in fact a radio recording. So we would be grateful if you could express your amusement in the most vocal way possible. Oh. What a wonderful little practice you had there. Thereby, of course, giving the impression to those listening in on the wireless at home that you are, in fact, enjoying yourselves.
So he's playing the announcer and also got all the sound effects, which I'm partly compiling for him at the moment, which is interesting.
And of course, yeah. The wonderful thing with these plays is you when you go on to perform them, it's done very much as if this is the 1955 and we're preparing to record this for the light program, isn't it? You know, with the on air side so. And the sound effects table and just the announcer, just the whole thing is it's a sort of like an immersive experience as well as a theatre play, isn't it? Well,
I think that's so important element you've picked up there. It's yes, a real theatrical evening. And I remember when we did it, and I bet you've had this as too, Colin. When we were first doing it, we did the radio episode. Some audience, not all of them, thank goodness, but some of them would be closing their eyes.
Yes, and they'd be exactly.
Drifting off, leaning back in their seats and just closing their eyes. And we were a bit concerned.
Oh, well, yeah. They're falling asleep on me, you know.
We're the dying of death here. What's going on? And then the director, Jonathan Rigby, who's played Kenneth Horne in the past, he came to see us. And he went, no. They're really wanting to really believe they are listening to that original cast. They are imagining yes. They are sat at home in front of their wireless
yep.
And they've got a cup of tea in one hand, they've got the cat yep. On their lap, and they're just imagining it rolling over them. And once I accepted that, I was like, that is very unique. There is not many stage shows you can have that kind of an experience with, a relationship with the audience with. And that was very, very nice indeed to think, wow, that is the power of this particular show. That's wonderful.
You've mirrored the exact same story.
Have you had it as well?
I tell you what, I've probably said it, I think, in every interview that I've ever given. So what's the sort of very unique reaction you get to these shows? And it is exactly that. You look out and for the first few rows, you see people with their eyes closed. Normally in a show you think, hello, what's going on here? You know? Start thinking, tapping the microphone, is this thing on? And as you say, it's people just basking in memories and realizing that they close their eyes. They are, and John, you're right, this is such an important point of these shows. It's part, without saying like a cliche, the real magic of these shows, what we recreate as a theatrical experience. It is people walking in to what would have been, the BBC London studios and witnessing a live recording of Hancock's Half Hour. It's quite a unique experience.
Indeed, I'm sure it must be.
And who else have we got? Oh, yes, Sid James. How could we forget Sidney, eh? Now, he was appearing somewhere. Now, where was it? Oh, yes, that's right. Bow Street Magistrates.
very funny. Now, look, keep it down, you lot. This is very important, this.
Oh, and pray tell, what is so important in your paper, Sidney?
Well, the 3:30 at Epsom, of course. I'm trying to pick a winner. Now, ladies and gentlemen, maybe you can help me here. Which of these two runners do you fancy, Early Mist or Likely Lad? Likely Lad it is.
And for the 10th show in a row, it's Likely Lad. Yes. This is the one time in my life I wish a horse did actually exist. Well, I think it's very uncouth of you, Sidney, to be involving the audience in your racing tips.
Yes. Well, you weren't complaining last week when you went 5 bob off that woman in the third row.
Yes, all right, all right. We won't talk about that.
This is a marks game.
That's true, yes.
I see.
Yeah?
Put us down for 5 bob each way on life and average,
eh? 5 bob at 10 to 1.
10 to 1?
And of course, the episodes that you're doing, so there's...
pen and paper, Colin, to write these down.
There you go.
What do you think I've got here in front of me, Van?
Oh, that's good. Yes.
So you're doing one episode from series 2, which is The Matador, which is quite similar to the existing TV episode, which is it The Holiday in Spain? No, what have we got the title wrong?
Spanish Interlude.
The Spanish Interlude.
Spanish Interlude, yeah.
Where
yeah.
Sid conns Hancock into being a matador. The New Neighbour, which is a lovely one from series 3, which was done by the Missing Hancock's guys for both radio and for the only one that they've recreated on television. The excellent Raider Planet, again from Series 3, where Sid again is twisting Tony by painting a red dot on his telescope that makes him think the Mars is incoming.
Spoiler alert! Oh, spoiler alert!
Yeah, so I was going to say.
In the first 30 seconds, it's fine. No spoilers here, but
say, Jonathan,
one.
Are you looking for a punch up the bracket?
Stone mate. And of course, then The Winter Holiday, which I'm sure John remembers doing a good 10 years ago when you were doing the Lost Hancocks as part of the Hambledon theatre tour. So
I love that episode.
Those ones you're doing, I gather you're doing sort of three of an evening, but it's going to sort of rotate between them.
We are. You emailed the other day asking which of these shows are we doing. And I must confess, I had absolutely no idea myself. I've just been reading the script because I thought, actually, which ones are we doing? But we, I think we're going to be alternating is what the producers have told us, that we're going to be really just having fun with them. And it's up to really the producers to what we play in what venues. So especially when we start in London, if people want to come on a different night, they'll probably see a different show.
Well, yeah, and that adds a bit of variety and makes it worth coming back twice for, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly makes me double check every time I start performing that I've got the right limit script in my hand.
That does help. Yeah.
I've done that once before, and very surreptitiously, sort of had to slide off stage and get the right script. Thankfully, I didn't have the opening line because I was reading it going, I've got the wrong bloody script here. Oh, God.
Yeah, that's not written down here.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
We're obviously recording this before the tour starts, but have you got a favourite of any of these episodes? Are you that familiar with them?
Well, because I'm sourcing a lot of sound effects at the moment, I'm very familiar with them by now. But sorry, John, after you actually, mate, what's your favourite one?
I do really like The Red Planet. I think that is one of the ones that makes me laugh out loud quite consistently throughout it. But I do have a soft spot for The Winter Holiday, just because I've done it before. And I remember when I was given the not even a task, but just the joy of getting to pick which episodes to recreate, that one leapt out because I thought it could be so theatrical because there's so much storms and waves going on. So I've had a message to Tim, and we made an authentic 1950s, it's like a tombola machine with a cloth over it. That sounds like wind.
Oh, yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wind.
Good morning, everybody. Come on, wake up. We're on holiday. Come on, throw back that sand. Get up. You're not going to lie in those waves all day, are you? Come on, Andre. Come out from under that lifeboat. Our first day on holiday, let's enjoy ourselves.
This is ridiculous. I'm freezing. Be all right under the pier.
Well, it kept the snow off. What's the matter with you?
Oh, Tony, I'm so cold.
Don't you start. You had the best place under the lifeboat.
It was horrible. I've never spent a more uncomfortable night. The wind kept blowing through the holes and Bill kept looking through them. Oh, I can't spend another night like that.
So I said to Tim, I was like, do you want me to bring that along? You know, and then we could have Clive in the corner cranking away like mad on this thing. And it's again a nice theatrical little joke. And then we'll all be like, you know, oh, there's the wind again and that kind of stuff. And it's nice. And we've got a wobble board, basically just a bit of ply that you can wobble around. And it sounds like thunder, a thunderboard. There's not a dud amongst them. There's not a dud amongst them. And actually, Colin, has Tim done that before? Like picked four episodes of Round the Horn? You've mixed it up every time. This is a new thing he's trying out.
Yes, well, no, because we've toured around the hall now, I think about last year was our fifth tour. So obviously we're revisiting a lot of venues. So we always tend to sort of perform new episodes every time. Or in cases around the hall, we tended to sort of cherry pick specific, because it was more sketch based. We tended to sort of cherry pick sketches and sort of compile sort of unique episodes, as it were. And so we were chopping and changing a lot of that all the time. We certainly did that with the Goon Show. I think we alternated Tales of Men's Shirts with another episode, but I don't think we've done it so far for Hancock. So it's going to be great fun, and it gives us a bit of variation as well.
It does,
of course. Keeps it fresh. I was going to say, helps keep it fresh.
Yes, yes.
It's a much longer tour this time, guys, isn't it?
I mean, tell us about it.
I mean, looking at the tour dates, I mean, it's just, I mean, are you going home at all? Or do you have, I imagine you in this like a tour bus, a bit like a 60s pop group going around the country, you know, sleeping in the van or whatever. And what happens in the van stays in the van type of stuff.
Yeah, what goes on tour stays on tour.
But look at October. You don't have a night off in October, I don't think, do you?
Just don't remind me.
I think that's come about because basically Tim's company is based down south and my company is based up north. And we had a meet-up in the lockdown, and Tim was saying, I find it quite difficult to get venues to book me up north. And I go, I get difficult venues to book me down south. And he said, well, I want to do a Steptoe radio show, but Tess has told me to obviously speak to you about it. And I was like, oh, yeah, we're doing a Christmas radio version that year we were. And he said, well, you know, let's you know, you carry on with that. And then if you want to, we can co-produce the next tour and, you know, we'll go that way around. And it was great. It's opened up so many doors, literally venue doors for both of us. So we've both been able to expand. Because this is what happens. You do a show one year at a venue and they go, oh, that was good. And you seem quite nice. And, you know, what are you doing next year? And part of you is going, oh, it's taken me 5 years to do this, actually. So can I just do this again? But, you know, it's nice. It's nice to have that kind of camaraderie amongst the industry. And me and Tim are both quite like-minded in that sense. So it's been nice that he's been able to open doors for my Tommy Cooper show when that goes back on tour next year. And we've opened a few doors for him with this Hancock show. So I think that's why it's quite an extensive one date-wise, yeah.
It's I think we're going to feel a little bit like that bit in Trains, Planes and Automobiles where John Candy says, I haven't been home in years. It's going to... I think it's going to feel like that part way through October. But I don't know about you, John, I love touring. It's absolutely fantastic. We're doing a lot of one-nighters, so it's going to be a lot of traveling on a day-to-day basis. But it's just it's a great way, I think, to see any part of the country or any part of the world. If you're traveling with work, I think it's one of the best things. And to be traveling with a production like Hancock is just going to be an absolute joy. But we've had lots of venues. And as you said, John, it's really a venue heavy this time. And we can be nothing but grateful.
Absolutely.
Oh, and to answer your question, was it favorite episode? Sorry, I didn't even, I passed that one on to you. I love John, the Red Planet. I think my personal favorite, for personal reasons, is probably the Winter Holiday.
And I've listened to that one today.
Well, I must say I love it because I'm based in Brighton. I lived in Brighton for over 20 years. And knowing quite how fierce that wind can be across the sea, it's...
Mate, have you been to Cleethorpes?
It's not so bad. A little bit of wind won't hurt you, and... That was a big wave, wasn't it? Bill, Andre, where are you?
Over here!
Well, swim back and stop messing about. You're not getting back to London that way. Now, come on, enjoy yourself. We've got the whole day in front of us.
Where are we going?
We're going to sit on the beach.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes, yes. What's the point in coming to Brighton if you don't sit on the beach? I always sit on the beach. Come on, the deck chairs.
we both got Scarborough. So we'll compare notes there, mate. I think that'll be a happy average.
But, I think
And I love performing in Brighton anyway. Brighton Theatre Royal, which is a fantastic venue. It's absolutely stunningly beautiful, and Brighton audiences are always absolutely fantastic. And to perform Kenneth Williams there as well is absolutely wonderful. But because Brighton features so heavily in the episode, there's that great line about you don't want to be in Brighton in October. You can always pop along the front
on the coast to Hove. Yes.
It's only an hour by donkey. And well, the in joke, if it's Southern Rail, it's probably an hour by that anyway these days. So in fact, you'd be better off getting the donkey, quite frankly.
We'll have goose pimples bigger than pebbles. I was figuring on somewhere warm, like Spain or Monte Carlo, Capri, Majorca.
You can always pop along the front to Hove. It's only a couple of hours by donkey.
I tell you, it's a mistake going to Brighton at this time of the year.
Rubbish, it's just right. The beaches will be deserted. Ah, luxury, yes. We'll be able to have our deck chairs stretched out to the last rung.
You've probably got to go back up to London and back down again, have you?
Yes, probably.
I was listening to the Red Planet the other day, and I've listened to it lots of times, but one line suddenly jumped out at me and I hadn't noticed before. And I think it's the Kenneth character that says it when Kenneth is playing a newspaper editor. I think Hancock is trying to get the newspaper guy involved in this discovery that he's made. And he says something like, it's not much of a story. He said, but I can sex it up.
And this planet is hurtling towards the Earth and will collide there on Christmas Day. We're all doomed unless something is done. And I want your newspaper to warn the world. Start a campaign immediately.
No, sorry. We've already got tomorrow's front page. What Rock Hudson's dog eats for breakfast. Phil, if you can sex it up a bit, we'll try and squeeze it in one of our strip cartoons next week.
See if you can sex it up a bit, and we'll see if we
include
him.
When I heard that, I thought surely the missing handcuffs would change that. From that wouldn't be in the script because that's a modern thing. And I looked back at the script, and it does say sex it up. And so I did a bit of delving on the internet and stuff because my recollection, which it mentions online, is that this came about in the one of the Middle Eastern wars when that dodgy dossier and everything, and in Tony Blair's time when they said they sexed up this dossier.
Oh, sex it up.
I remember that.
How Saddam Hussein was nuclear ready or whatever. Anyway, that's where I'd first heard. And when you look at the meaning of this phrase online, it refers to that. But there's also a bit online from the Oxford English Dictionary. Now, I couldn't see all of it because it's behind a paywall. But what it says is that this expression comes from 1955. Well, that's where this episode comes from.
Okay.
Yes.
Very contemporary.
I just wonder whether it was a Golden Simpson original.
Oh, it could well be then.
Wouldn't be the first.
Who knows?
Unless it was a topical reference, someone had said it at the time and they picked up on it.
It could well be. I mean, they were quite good at putting in the topical things, and you forget how topical it is with the hindsight of 60 years later. It could well be. But they did pick up a lot of different sort of phrases that weren't necessarily in print that were commonplace at the time and included them in their scripts, didn't they? I mean, the wonderful line in The Red Planet that I love is, there it is, the sailor's friend. What, the North Star? No, Mrs. Higgins.
No, Mrs. Higgins.
Yes.
Yes, well, according to the chart, the North Star should be approximately 2'9" to the left of Mrs. Higgins' television aerial. Let's have a look. Yes, there she is, the sailor's friend.
The North Star.
No, Mrs. Higgins.
Again, a little bit blue, but just on the right side of blue, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love the ending of that where he says, you're sort of, the implication is he's never going to be fooled by it again, and suddenly there's the blue circle on the telescope, and he comes running down saying, "Evacuate! We've got to get the government involved again." It's just a brilliant ending.
It certainly is.
When they did that back in 1955, Hancock would have been aware that his hero, who was Will Hay, one of his heroes, he was actually a part-time astronomer.
Didn't he discover something, didn't he, with
a
these...
A, A spot on Saturn is what that he's alleged to have discovered.
And of course, there's some wonderful, in both The New Neighbour and The Red Planet in particular, some wonderful little sort of two scenes with the Ken and the Hancock character that you see will have the pleasure of doing. Because there's the thing with him as the policeman in The New Neighbour, and I think he's a policeman again in The Red Planet, but he's set there. Ken is various different characters of ministry types and such, and there's some lovely sort of two-handers between each character.
Yeah, there are those lovely exchanges, aren't they, John? I think we're going to really enjoy doing it. So, so much fun to do, as you know yourself, mate.
I do remember the snide character in The Winter's Holiday. He's a lifeguard, isn't he? And
that's right.
The house down. It's like when you talked about when Sid James, you know, Ben in this case, has his first appearance. You know, that's, you know, it's one of those moments. It's a theatre, you know, they relax a little bit. It's what it is, really. They go, oh, good. It's James. That's what they do. They relax. Like all of us, hopefully. And I remember that's when the snide character comes in that episode. Quite late on, isn't it? It's like the last 2 or 3 minutes.
Yes.
Help! I can't swim. I can't move. The tide's coming in. Help, I'll drown.
Oh, what a holiday this is. Nothing else can happen.
Good evening.
It's happened. Who are you?
I'm the lifeguard.
Keep him away! Don't let him come near me!
Can I be of any assistance?
I'd be very surprised.
Oh, don't be like that.
What are you doing out there?
Drowning. Would you like to change places?
Drowning, eh? Oh, it's not a very nice day for it, is it?
Aren't you going to save him? Help!
Oh, no, I can't save him.
Why not?
Well, it's not my area. I've got that half a beach up there. This bit's got nothing to do with me at all.
Well, whose is it?
Wait a minute, let's see now. This bit here, this would be... Yes, this is Cyril's bit.
And where is he?
Oh, he's on his holidays.
Help! I'm drowning!
Well, swim over to the left a couple of 100 yards. That's my bit.
I can't swim.
Well, that makes it a bit awkward, don't it?
Why?
Neither can I.
And the audience go, oh, good, he's going to be in this one, basically.
If he's flagging in the last third, they often pop snide
in,
don't
they?
Yeah.
They hold off on him. And I remember that was because you'll understand, Colin, well, anyone who's done any kind of live performance, when you've got some guaranteed gags, you do relax a little bit more.
Of course. I think it's always, especially when you're playing, again, we've all got iconic voices in this, but I suppose because Kenneth is such a unique voice, you can't really say that he's like anyone else. It's, again, John, it's like the to be or not to be sequence in Hamlet. It's the bit that everyone kind of leans into to go, oh, you know, is it any good? Can he do it?
So what are they going to do this time?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when you sort of, when you come out with it, yeah, oh, I know, hopefully people will sort of relax and go, oh, fantastic. And that's just a great reaction.
Well, I'm looking forward to coming down and see you in Swindon, I think, towards the back end of the tour. I think that's the most likely date I'll be going, so I'm really, really excited to see your guys' performance.
Make sure you come and see us after us, buddy, as well. Unless, we're shooting off somewhere else. I don't know if they...
Yeah, I mean, you're probably somewhere else next day, other end of the country on the 4th. But I'll put my hand up.
Are you going to take Monty with you, James?
I'll ask him. Yeah, I think so. I'm going to get 2 tickets, so either Monty or my dad, I think. Well, my dad's still a big, big fan, so...
I have to flip a coin.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yep. See who's behaving.
Tim and I are coming along next week. Is it?
Excellent.
Wednesday, Tim?
Wednesday night, yeah. Yeah.
Wednesday night.
We've been in touch with the theatre to see if we can take a little display along or something, but I think there's a problem at Jermyn Street in that it's very small and very tight space, but we'll see what we can do. We might just hand out leaflets or something, but
he's got a small little lobby.
Has it?
Area, yes. There's a small bit. They are such a lovely venue. Penny who runs the place is absolutely fantastic. I was lucky enough to perform there last year because, in addition to sort of playing Kenneth in Hancock and Round the Horn, I've also written a one-man show which I'm obviously mercilessly plugging at the moment, called Cult Figure, which is my one-man show, my tribute to Kenneth Williams. And we were there for a week, pretty much a year from when we're performing next week, a year ago last August. And audiences were great. It's a fantastic venue. And it's going to be a really lovely place to start. It's very intimate. I don't know what the capacity is. I think it's about 100 or something like that. But you see the audience, you see the whites of their eyes. And I don't know about you, John, but I love that.
Or their eyelids if their eyes are closed.
Well, indeed.
Yes, exactly. If they're wearing mascara, it's easy enough to tell. Yeah, exactly. So, yes, it's, as you say, it's a great, as you will find out, rather, it's a lovely venue and they're very, very welcoming.
Good. Yeah. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, they're really looking forward to that.
Yes, and you're going all around the houses. I think you're in Essex towards the end of your tour as well, which is probably when I'll catch up with you. Chelmsford and like that.
We're going up north and around and everywhere. It's one of those things, I think, John, as you know, when you're on the road, you don't talk about the show a lot of the time. You just talk about what your digs are like and where you think you've got to go to next. Yeah. You can't actually remember even what day it is.
No, they do start to blend a little bit, don't they?
Yes. I do actually have to start. I always say to myself, I'm going to keep a diary, not to be all method, as to be like Kenneth Williams, but just so I can actually remind myself a week or even a year later. God, where were we this time last? I can't even remember where we were and what the theatres were like. It's fantastic.
There's even a joke about along those lines, and I think it's the impersonator, the last Hancock's Half Hour radio episode, where he's, thank you, Huddersfield. Hamptonshire.
Streatham.
Gets it wrong, gets corrected.
I don't remember where he is.
And that's what being on tour on the road must be like, yeah.
It's always a great thrill to play to such highly receptive, critical, and highly intelligent audiences as one always finds here in Middlesbrough.
Huddersfield.
Yes, of course, Huddersfield. And we all look forward to the day when we will be able to return to the stage of this magnificent theatre of yours, the Alhambra. The Empire, yes. Thank you very much. Look after yourselves. Have a good weekend. Be nice to each other and drive carefully. Farewell, Bolton, Huddersfield.
Have a plate of Arthurs.
Yeah, a plate of Arthurs.
In Nanook of the North, they put cornflakes in front of a fan or something, wasn't it?
At Newcastle on Tyne, in my rendition of Hamlet, halfway through the ghost scene when I was reeling back saying, "What is this I see before me?" There came from the back of the stalls a distinct cry, "A bowl of Harper's, mate!" In Nanook of the North, even the stagehands started taking the mickey. I opened the door of my igloo in the frozen north and walked straight out into a cornflake storm.
The cornflake blizzard.
Wonderful stuff.
It's with a lot of these venues, they're absolutely fantastic. So you look out into these beautiful venues, but often the only thing you remember of the towns or the cities themselves is probably the stage door in the local Tesco's and what they had on special offer before you were going to go up.
And the techies.
And the techies, yeah.
And the parking.
Yes. Your nightmare will be parking, John. My nightmare will probably be Southern Trains and Thames Link.
Close to the train station. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Bring it on.
And of course, we should say for details of the tour, you should visit www.apollotheatrecompany.com, and all the dates of the tour are up there. And I think there's dates still to be added or confirmed as well, aren't there, at the moment? So
quite possibly, yes.
Possibly.
We've certainly got Brighton on the October the 16th, which I don't think is currently on the website for the Apollo, but the tickets are now. The tickets are certainly available. But we're touring extensively. We've got a lot of different venues, but people can book, as you say, through Apollo Theatre website, and that will take you to links to all the theatres.
Perfect.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
Have we run out of things to say?
Anything else that you wanted to quiz our lovely actor lovelies while we've got them at all with?
I've never been so insulted, disgusting, really.
Quite right.
No, I think that's it. We've talked ourselves through all chats and questions then. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you, chaps. And
thanks to the tour.
Yeah, great to talk to you guys.
Very welcome.
Yeah,
you're very welcome.
Really
guys.
Forward to seeing it.
Yeah, make sure you come and say hello after the show. Please do.
Definitely will.
Yes,
definitely
will. Do.
Oh, yes, certainly.
We will see you hopefully then on Wednesday.
Excellent. Cheers, Martin.
Take care.
Good luck.
Bye now.
Take care.
Thanks for your time.
See you Friday.
Cheers,
bye.
Bye.
Bye,
mate.
Bye-bye.
Safe journey.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I guess that's about it for today, so take it away, Tim.
Why not join us in the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society today? You can find us at tonyhancock.org.uk for all the information on how to join.
For just £13 a year, you'll have access to the members area of our website and receive 4 magazines a year by email, packed with information on Tony, his shows and archive material.
Members also get a digital-only bonus page of supplements every quarter.
Or you can have full-colour printed copies posted to your door for £16 in the UK or £26 worldwide.
And we're a friendly and welcoming bunch, so please do join. We have reunion events with archive displays, guest speakers and special screenings.
Please get in touch. We'd love questions, conundrums and feedback. To do so is very easy. Send your emails to podcast@tonyhancock.org.uk.
Also, keep an eye on our social media accounts, particularly X, the social media account formerly known as Twitter, for all the latest news on the podcast and all things Hancock. Our Twitter accounts are East Team Lad, Tony Hancock Appreciation Society, and Very Nearly an Armful.
We'll be back to continue the series in November, when we will be looking at the oldest surviving TV episode, The Alpine Holiday.
For now, that's Very Nearly an Armful, so I'll say ta-ta.
It's sayonara from me,
Chickity Stitch,
and this is GLK London, closing down for a quick cough and a drag.
And of course, while Tim has his cough and a drag, he can look at the sailor's friend, not the North Star, Mrs. Higgins, across the way.
This has been an official podcast of the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society. Unfortunately, it was not written by Alan Simpson and Ray Gordon, whoever they are. The announcer was me, Robin Sebastian, currently appearing in the saloon bar of the Hand and Racket.
Are you, because I'm sort of talking as though we're not broadcasting anymore, is this...
I think this is post...
We've switched off.
Podcast.
We've switched off.
Hang
on, I don't have to switch myself off. Sorry about that.
Being the oldest existing I'll have a run at that.
Oldest
surviving. Yeah. I'm gonna say surviving.
Started the series, Martin, and you're
Talk, mate.
And clearly nor can I.
Yeah, well, yeah.